Michael Behe holds his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Pennsylvania and has authored a best-selling book titled Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. He is an intelligent design advocate and is best known for his argument for irreducible complexity. Dr. Behe has been published by numerous peer-reviewed journals and has also written editorial features in Boston Review, American Spectator, and New York Times. He currently serves as a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania and is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. This evening, we will start with Dr. Behe's lecture entitled The Limits of Darwinism, followed by a question and answer period. Without further ado, please join me in a warm welcome once again with Dr. Michael Behe.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here with you. Let me just get this line up here first. I've been to Canada several times, but never had the privilege of being to university here. And I have to admit, I really think your campus is beautiful. So tonight, as it was mentioned, I'm going to talk on what are the limits of Darwinism. But before I start in on that, whenever I talk, I put up a disclaimer because Darwinism and intelligent design and things I'm going to talk about are really controversial topics. So I do not speak for my colleagues. I do not speak for my university. My mother disagrees with me. So it's just me you're hearing here. About 15 or so years ago, I wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And in that, the argument was that I thought that some things in biology could not be explained by Darwinian processes. And I went on to argue that they're better explained by intelligent design.
I'm not going to talk about that tonight. Rather, I'm going to talk about a broader topic. And that is this. If you're a person like myself who thinks there are limits to what Darwinian processes can do and that intelligence is necessary to explain much of life, then an interesting question is, where's the broad dividing line between those two? What is in the title of the book, what's the edge of evolution? Or what are the limits to Darwinism? And before you start to talk about evolution or Darwinism, you have to be careful to define your terms, because both of those words can mean different things at different times to different people. And so even Darwinism, some people talk about Darwin's theory, but it turns out that Darwin's theory has multiple separable logical elements in it, some of which might be right and some of which might be wrong. The famous historian of science, Ernst Mayr, once counted 9 separate theories in Darwin's theory. I'm not a historian, so I am going to concentrate on what I think are the 3 main elements of Darwin's theory, or elucidate them, or list them, and then concentrate on one of them. One of the first parts of Darwin's theory is the idea of common descent. And that's simply the idea that the organisms today, modern organisms, are descended by birth and death from organisms that lived in the misty past. And that's an interesting idea, in my opinion, and it's a very interesting claim about natural history. But in a strong sense, it's really not all that important. It's kind of trivial, at least in the sense that it doesn't explain where those ancestors came from. And it doesn't by itself explain how we got to modern organisms. It just says that modern organisms are descended. The second point of Darwinism is the idea of natural selection. Okay, so here's his attempt at least part of a mechanism for explaining common descent. And natural selection says if you have a population of a species, and some members of a species are bigger than others, some are faster, better adapted to their environment, then the ones that are better adapted are, by and large, more likely to survive and pass on their traits to their offspring. And if more of them survive than organisms that don't have those particular traits, then the traits will spread throughout the species over the next generation. And again, I think that's a very interesting idea. Nobody really thought of that specifically before Darwin, and it's a very interesting concept. But once again, it's kind of trivial, because who's going to doubt the contention that an organism that is better fit to its environment is, on average, going to do better than an organism that isn't? Okay, so it's interesting, but in a sense, it's not the real meat of Darwin's theory. What I think is the key to Darwin's theory, which carries 95% of its weight, both scientifically and philosophically, is the idea of random mutation, or random variation, in Darwin's words. The critical claim of Darwinism is that random changes in organisms, and mutations as we would call it these days, are sufficient to supply the fodder for natural selection to winnow through and build the complex systems that we have, that science has discovered in life. So I'm going to spend most of my talk concentrating on this idea of random mutation. But before I do this, I want to shock you. And it's nothing personal about myself. It's something else. It has to do with an observation made by an English writer named G.K. Chesterton about 100 years ago. And in one of his books, Chesterton said, "Nursery tales say that apples were golden, only to refresh the forgotten moment when we found that they were green. They make rivers run with wine, only to make us remember for one wild moment that they run with water." And of course, the point of the quotation is that many things in our world we take for granted, but if we step back and look at them afresh, they're really fantastic. And Chesterton says that many nursery tales serve that purpose. Well, in my experience, Darwinism, Darwinian theory, has become so much a part of our modern society, kind of so much a part of the air we breathe, that we take it for granted. And we say, well, of course it's true. My teachers told me that in school. And so I want you to see it afresh. And like Chesterton, in order to do that, I'm going to talk about not a modern nursery tale, maybe better say a modern fairy tale. And that modern fairy tale is the following. Star Trek and the Borg. Anybody here ever see Star Trek? All right, a couple people here, man. Good. Okay, for that guy who didn't, Star Trek is, of course, the name of a TV show where a bunch of humans and a bunch of things that look like humans but aren't go on a ship and explore the universe. And the Borg is a race of bad guys. They're half humanoid, half machine. And they live in, or they exist in some sort of collective where they have a common mind or something. And their purpose seems to be simply to absorb other races and beings into the Borg collective. So they go through space relentlessly, we are told, to absorb whoever they can. And they do it by employing a certain kind of technology, nanotechnology. And here we nanotechnology is a word used to describe devices so small that the naked eye cannot see them. The Borg Collective is infamous for their use of nanotechnology to advance their goals, specifically assimilating new members and technologies with nanoprobes. And this is from the internet, so you know it's right. And on the next slide, we see here's a screenshot of some evil machine, nanotechnology, trying to do something with these red blood cells. I won't describe what it is. And we know it's evil because it's got all these projections coming out of it and stuff. And here's some bloke in the poor bloke in the process of being absorbed into the Borg. Now, here's the kicker. In at least one sense, in the sense of using nanotechnology, you are the Borg. You are run by tiny machines which live inside you. You have been assimilated. And to back that up, let's look at this journal issue of the journal Cell, a very prominent biology journal. 10 years ago, it issued a special issue entitled Macromolecular Machines. Macro just means big. Big Molecular Machines. And if you look on the inside to the table of contents of this journal, you find articles with titles such as The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines, Polymerases and the Replisome, Machines Within Machines, Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome, Motors, Clocks, Springs, and Things. So it is no exaggeration. You and essentially all of life on Earth is run by nanotechnology. And here's a picture or a computer drawing of one of those molecular machines. It's not one that was mentioned on the table of contents, but it's something called a psyllium. And I just want to, I'm not going to tell you what it really does or how it does it. I just want to point out all the parts, different parts that it has, and all these parts are necessary for it to work. But the real purpose of taking a look at this computer drawing is to show you what journal it was published in. It was published in Nanotechnology. So the great discovery, I would say, of biology in the 20th century, and especially in the late 20th century, is that life is based not on jelly, not on protoplasm, but on very specific, sophisticated, elegant molecular machinery. Okay, so life is based on elegant molecular machinery. So what? What does this have to do with Darwin's theory? Well, one thing it has to do is it would be a big surprise to himself because he and all scientists of his age had really no conception of the cell or of what it contained. Scientists of the age, or a lot of them, thought that the cell was a glob of jelly called protoplasm. And as a matter of fact, this particular drawing was thought to be a cell by a man named Ernst Haeckel and another named Thomas Huxley, who were friends of Darwin. And they were given this by one of the great English exploring ships who dredged it up from the bottom of the sea. And they thought that it looked like a cell. So they thought that cells could spontaneously generate from mud at the sea bottom. And so Huxley generously named the cell Bathybius haeckelii, because he didn't want to name it after himself. Why is it? Well, we know that this has turned out to be totally wrong, a totally wrong conception of the foundation of life. And instead of the simple jelly, which wouldn't seem to be very hard to produce anyway and would fit nicely with Darwin's theory, the cell has proved to be essentially a factory employing nanotechnology that we humans have yet to conquer. Okay, so that's one problem for Darwin, and that is that life has turned out to be based on technology that he did not know anything about. Another one has to do with kind of a technical concept, and it's called an evolutionary fitness landscape. Some of the population biologists a while back invented this concept. And the idea is that here on the z-axis is measured the fitness of an organism. The higher it is, the more fit is the organism. So down here, it's kind of wimpy. Up here, it's super organism. And on the x and y-axes are they're labeled genotype space. So you can think of them as the sequence of DNA in various places. The idea is that if some organism starts off here, well, maybe a mutation can come along which would put him right here. And now he is fitter than the average of the rest of his population. And so he can go on and have offspring that inherit this fitness. And then maybe somewhere down the line, another mutation comes along, which raises its fitness to over here. And the same process continues. Then over to here, and here, and here, and here, and here, until it gets to the very top of the fitness landscape. And then it's pretty much there, because there's no place further to go. But as was realized for a long time, this is really kind of an idealized landscape. It's a kind of a cartoon version of what we'd really expect in life. Many population biologists now think that with the molecular machinery and various complexities we've discovered at the bottom of life, that a more realistic landscape looks like this. Kind of looks like a badlands. And they call it a rugged evolutionary fitness landscape. Now let's look at that same process that we thought about here, but on a landscape like this. Now if we have a mutation here, it might work its way up to this localized peak. But now it's kind of stuck, because if it mutates, it's likely to become less fit. And even if it goes up to a higher peak, again, it's stuck and can't go very far in any direction, because each direction it goes is downward. And that means it would become less fit than its offspring. Furthermore, we can see the coherence of biological systems, but there is no coherence in a rugged evolutionary fitness landscape. You can get to the top of a peak, but if you were asking yourself, how can an animal or some organism get from this peak over to here, there is no driving force. Natural selection only drives things up. There's nothing directional about going through the fitness landscape. And so that's a problem that has many biologists scratching their heads. Including the realistic landscape is what I call incoherent. That means that an improvement in one trait doesn't do anything to improve anything else, and it doesn't take you from one place in the landscape to another. The only way that Darwin's mechanism of natural selection can take an organism is up. Okay, can't take it to the left or the right or whatever. And as I said, many biologists scratch their heads over this, including some computer scientists who are essentially evolutionary computationists. And a few years back, a man named Richard Watson, who's in an English university, wrote a book called Compositional Evolution, The Impact of Sex Symbiosis and Modularity on the Gradualist Framework. And in it, he wrote that in computer science, we recognize the algorithmic principle described by Darwin, the linear accumulation of small changes through random variation and selection, as hill climbing. More specifically, random mutation hill climbing. However, we also recognize that hill climbing is the simplest possible form of optimization and is known to work well only on a limited class of problems. So yes, the mechanism described by Darwin, or the algorithmic principle, does work in some simple cases, especially when you have an idealized landscape where only one or maybe two variables can change at a time, in things like antibiotic resistance for one, or other cases. So Watson wrote that in 2006, but it really hasn't had much of at least an impact on the public face of evolutionary theory. Many biologists will agree with Richard Dawkins, who's perhaps the most prominent popularizer of Darwin's theory alive. A long time ago, 25 years plus now, he wrote his famous book, The Blind Watchmaker, which is a strong defense of Darwin's theory. And he asks the same question that, well, we've been asking. He said, "We have seen that living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed, quote unquote, to have come into existence by chance. How then did they come into existence? By gradual, step-by-step transformations from simple beginnings." But that's the exact thing that Richard Watson says is difficult for the Darwinian mechanism to do. So what are we to do here? You know, this guy, Richard Watson, you know, whoever he is, thinks there's a problem. Richard Dawkins, everybody knows who he is. He's a famous guy. He says there's no problem. Okay. So are we just going to go with Dawkins because he's cool and Richard Watson we don't know much about? Well, in science, that's probably not the best way to resolve a question. Rather, in science, what you want to do is get more data. Oh, I skipped a good joke because I don't have time. So let's ask ourselves, what is our best evidence of what Darwinian processes can actually do? And it turns out that that question couldn't be answered not too long ago. 10, 15 years ago, everybody knew evolution took so long and required so many organisms that, you know, your federal grant would run out before you answered the question of what Darwinism could do. But in the past 10 years, it turns out with the advance of many techniques in science and the advance of observation, we have been able to look at a huge number of organisms over a long number of generations. And so I think we do have some evidence as to what Darwinian processes can actually do. And I'm going to argue that the best evidence we have to assess the abilities of Darwinian processes comes from studies of malaria, both in the genetic changes of humans and in the parasite, which is called Plasmodium falciparum, itself. Okay, and the reason for that is, well, number one, malaria, as most of you know, is a horrific disease. It used to be more widespread, but it's still spread pretty far in the world. And it kills on the order of 1 million people per year, mostly children under the age of 5. So we study malaria because we're interested in ourselves and we're interested in our health. And so there have been many, here's the reasons. We have detailed genetic studies of it because we study it for our own health and because of the sheer population sizes involved. Many people, perhaps 1 billion people a year, get malaria. And there's an astronomical number of malarial organisms on the planet, which we'll see in a little while. So that's what I think is gives us our best look at what Darwinism actually does. And here's just a little cartoon to remind you of what happens when we get malaria. First, a malarial parasite is actually a single-celled creature, which is carried by a fly or by a mosquito, and the poor mosquito itself is a victim too. It's no happier to be infested by malaria than a person is. But anyway, an infected mosquito bites a person, and some malarial parasites enter the person and head towards his liver, hang out there a while, and after a couple weeks, they transform and enter into the bloodstream. And what happens here is that a single malarial parasite, you see that little gray dot there on this red blood cell, attaches itself to the red blood cell and pulls itself into the cell. And in the cell, it eats the hemoglobin that red blood cells contain. Hemoglobin is the protein that carries oxygen from your lungs to your extremities. And it uses the energy and materials that it gets from the hemoglobin to make about 20 copies of itself. And here's the final stage where the 20 copies have been made and it bursts open the now trashed red blood cell. And each one of these 20 copies attaches itself to another red blood cell. And in the next round, 400 malarial parasites come out. And in the next round, 8,000. And in a short time, enough have come out that a large fraction of the person's blood is consumed. So these guys are really like microscopic Draculas. Okay, well, it turns out that the human genome has been at war with malaria for 10,000 years. And in that time, there have been mutations that have arisen in the human genome, which have conferred upon the people lucky enough to have them resistance to the malarial parasite. And the most famous of these is the sickle gene for sickle hemoglobin. And here's a map of the overlap of the ranges of malaria in blue and the sickle cell gene in pink, and the overlap areas in purple. And you can see there's a pretty good correspondence between the overlap, which served as kind of prima facie evidence that it was providing some protection for these people. And that has since been thoroughly confirmed. You see these little islands where there's sickle cell gene, but no malaria. And most of these places are highlands where mosquitoes can't live. But the people who live there migrate there from the surrounding area. Okay, this is a classic example of Darwinian evolution. And most biology texts, I think, when they discuss evolution, show a picture similar to this. And oftentimes tout it as showing the strength of Darwinian evolution. But what is the mutation that causes the sickle gene? What causes the ability to resist malaria? Well, here's a cartoon drawing of the molecular structure of a hemoglobin molecule. I'm sure most of you will recognize it. It consists of four polypeptide chains, and they are composed of amino acids. And everybody knows amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. Well, there are four chains, two alpha chains and two beta chains. The beta chains here are in dark blue, and the alpha are in light blue. This is normal hemoglobin. In sickle hemoglobin, one of these amino acids changes to a different one. I forgot to make this point. I just wanted to show you a little scale. This is hemoglobin, and here's a picture of the cilium that we looked at before, that molecular machine that was published in Nanotechnology. The size of the hemoglobin is about the size of one of these light blue dots in here. So that just gives you a sense of the scale. So as far as molecular machines goes, this is pretty small. Where is this mutation? Well, as we said before, hemoglobin is a chain of amino acid residues. And here you can just see single letters, and each one represents the name of an amino acid residue. And there are two different chains in hemoglobin, two alphas, two betas. So here's the alpha chain. Here's the sequence of the beta chain. They have similarities, but they're not identical. And in the sickle hemoglobin, one of them has changed. In the beta chain, the number 6 position, the glutamic acid that was there is substituted by a valine. So one crummy amino acid change out of 300 is sufficient to change this into sickle hemoglobin. So what does this change do? Well, it turns out that the valine is an oily amino acid. And that change from glutamic acid, which is a water-loving amino acid, allows this region now to associate or stick together with another oily patch on the surface of another hemoglobin molecule. And since hemoglobin has twofold symmetry, then the valine of the second molecule can associate with an oily patch on the third hemoglobin molecule, and that with a fourth, and that with a fifth and sixth. And this can go on indefinitely. And it does whenever the sickle hemoglobin changes from oxygenated form to the deoxygenated form. And here's an electron micrograph of a red blood cell containing sickle hemoglobin, which has been deoxygenated. And you see these long fibrous type tubules. This is the polymerized sickle hemoglobin. Notice that it's bursting the red blood cell. Now, it turns out that if a person has two sickle hemoglobin genes, they inherit one, say, from their mom and another from their dad, then they have sickle cell disease. And this sort of thing happens very easily. Each time a red blood cell goes from an artery to a vein, from an area of high oxygen concentration to an area of low oxygen concentration. But, you know, and this is a very severe condition, and people that have it in countries that lack advanced medical care usually die by the age of 10 or so. But if a person inherits one copy of the sickle cell gene, but inherits a copy of regular hemoglobin from one of their parents, then they have what's called sickle cell trait. And only half of the hemoglobin in their cells is sickle, and half is normal. And that cell does not sickle nearly as easily as does one from a person with sickle cell disease. Here's an electron micrograph of normal red blood cells, and here's sickled red blood cells. And deoxygenating the cells from people with sickle cell trait does not turn them into the sickled form. They stay in the normal form. However, when a sickle cell trait blood cell is invaded by a malarial parasite, that causes the sickling of the cell. And it's thought that that actually helps because the spleen recognizes the cell as aberrant. And the spleen's job is to destroy aberrant blood cells. And it destroys the sickle cell along with a malarial parasite that's inside of it. Now, normal red blood cells are kind of like water balloons that are, say, two-thirds full. They're kind of squishy and deformable and stuff. And that's good and actually helpful because the capillaries, the smallest capillaries that red blood cells go through are actually smaller in diameter than the diameter of the blood cell. So it has to squish in and elongate a little bit to go through. And the squishing is actually helpful because that makes a shorter distance for the oxygen to diffuse to the tissues on the sides of the capillary. Sickle blood cells are like little bags of solidified cement. And when they go to a capillary, they get stuck there. And that stops blood flow. And it deprives the surrounding tissue of oxygen. And the tissue then dies, and that's what causes the problems. And we've still got, this is a story from about 10 years or so ago, we've still got problems with sickle cell disease. There's really no cure for it, even in our advanced scientific age. Well, the sickle mutation is one type of mutation. It's called a substitution mutation. And that's just where, of course, you know, you switch one kind of, in the DNA, you switch one kind of a unit of DNA, which is called a nucleotide, for another one. And for DNA that codes for proteins, that sometimes leads to switching the amino acid that it codes for to a different amino acid. And that's what happens in sickle cell. The glutamic acid gets replaced by a valine. Now, if you think about it, it's helpful, the sickle mutation, but it's not what you'd call real elegant. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a crummy mutation because people who get two sickle cell genes die. And so the helpfulness of the mutation is mitigated by the fatal condition of people who inherit two copies of the gene. Additionally, if you're thinking about molecular machines and so on, the mutation does not even occur in the immune system, which is the system of the body which is responsible for defending us against microscopic invaders. It seems like a kind of a desperate effort rather than a part of an integrated, coherent system. Well, be that as may, it is still a good illustration of Darwinian evolution because you have a mutation which has a selectable property and spreads because of it. Well, there are other kinds of DNA mutations too. Substitution is just one kind. There's a kind of mutations called deletions. And as the name implies, that happens when an accident occurs while DNA is replicated and one or more nucleotides are left out of the newly made DNA. And there's mutations called insertions, which, again, by accident, one or more nucleotides are added to the DNA. And there are inversions, where a segment of DNA is flipped over and restitched backwards into the place where it was, and other types as well. And it turns out that there are many, many different possible kinds of mutations in the human genome. For example, just think of substitutions. There are 3 billion, more than 3 billion nucleotides in the human genome. And each one of them, there are 4 different kinds of nucleotides. So each nucleotide can be substituted by 3 other kinds to have a mutation. So there's 3 times 3 billion which is close, call it 10 billion possible substitution mutations which could occur in the human genome. And there's zillions of possible deletion mutations, because you can delete between this section here and this here, or this here and that here. The ends of it are variable. Same thing with other ones. So there are, I'll bet, trillions of different kinds of possible mutations in the human genome. And yet, there's only a handful that have been found to be helpful against malaria. And I said sickle hemoglobin was the most famous, and it is, but there are other ones too. Let's look at some of those. We know that hemoglobin S can lead to sickle cell disease. Well, there's another mutation called alpha thalassemia, where the gene that codes for the alpha chain of hemoglobin is broken or deleted, thrown away. And while that does help a bit in defending a person against malaria, it's a degradatory mutation. You break the gene. Another helpful mutation is called beta thalassemia, where the gene for the beta chain of hemoglobin is broken or thrown away. And again, it helps, but at the cost of a broken gene. Something called hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin breaks the genetic controls that turn off the production of the kind of hemoglobin that is produced in fetuses. In a different gene, a gene called glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, delete it or accumulate point mutations in it. And that helps. For some reason, that helps. But again, you lose the function of that gene. Another one, BAN3 protein, is a protein that is found in the membrane of red blood cells. Delete it. And if you inherit one copy of the deleted gene, you have some resistance to malaria. If you inherit two copies of it, you don't get to be born. The fetus dies in utero. Let's look back at a paper by a lady named Sarah Tishkoff and others, who first showed that glucose-6-phosphate deficiency is helpful with malaria. And the authors write that with the classic examples of sickle cell anemia and thalassemia, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency represents one of the best examples of natural selection acting on the human genome. Let me emphasize that. These are the best examples of what random mutation and selection do to a genome. They're all helpful, but they all break things down or lead to various diseased states. So what I would like to emphasize is the following, that much Darwinian evolution proceeds by breaking old genes, by breaking them rather than making new ones. And we can understand why that's the case. It's easy to understand that because breaking something or disabling a gene will occur at a rate hundreds of times faster than making a specific change in a gene. Suppose that for some beneficial mutation that would help improve a protein, you had to change this amino acid over there into something else. But you could also get a selective benefit by taking this gene here and either deleting it or changing any amino acid to something that would cause it to lose function, or breaking out pieces in the middle, or some combination of that. Because there are so many more ways to do that, so many more ways to break a gene than to make one or make changes in one, then evolution by breaking things will be expected to occur much, much faster than evolution by making improvements. And again, let me emphasize that out of all the many possible mutations in the human genome, very, very few of the possible mutations were helpful. handful out of all those possible changes. And one last point, that the changes are incoherent. That is, breaking the controls for, you know, fetal hemoglobin and breaking glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase are not adding up to any new system. They're just random different things that happen in the genome to help protect somebody from malaria. So here's a kind of a picture that I want to show you about random mutation. I got this off the internet too. And your genome is full of fine, exquisite functional machinery. And making random changes in functional machinery is much, much more likely to break something than it is to make an improvement. Now, this was people, and we know a whole lot about people because we're the most interesting things we can think about, and so we study ourselves a lot. But it turns out that evolution experiments have been done in other organisms over the past couple decades, and the most spectacular one has been run by a man named Richard Lenski, who's a professor of microbiology at Michigan State University. And for the past 25 years or so, he's been growing these little buggers. These are E. coli, a bacterium, in flasks in his lab. And each day, he grows bugs in a flask, and they can go through 10 generations before the flask gets full. And the next morning, he comes in and takes a small aliquot and feeds it into another flask where they can undergo another 10 generations. And the next morning, another 10 generations. And his lab is currently up to 50,000 generations of E. coli, which is equivalent to something on the order of a million years of in generation times for large animals like people. And he did this because he wanted to see what evolution would do with the cultures of E. coli. And surprisingly, it does something very similar to what is done to the human genome by its attempt to defend itself against the malarial parasite. Here's from one of his kind of summary papers. He talks about, he says, expression of both the ribose operon and the maltose regulon decreased after 20,000 generations of experimental evolution. These changes may therefore reflect beneficial mutations in these regulons. Indeed, deletions of the ribose operon were found previously in all 12 of the evolved populations. In other words, deleting these genes, throwing them away, breaking them, helped this organism. Exactly what they did is kind of up in the air. I mean, why they were helpful is up in the air. But nonetheless, he showed clearly that breaking them was beneficial. They outcompeted their sibling bacterium. He looked at, here's another four genes that they looked at, and they saw that multiple changes at different sites in the genome, in the genes rather, was helpful for the bacterium, made it grow faster. And this indicates that, in fact, the mutations are damaging the gene, because you can damage a gene in many places. But if you were trying to make a specific helpful change in one gene, you'd expect to see the same mutation occurring over and over again. So the point, again, is that it's much like the malarial mutations in people, that Darwinian random mutation much more easily breaks things than makes things, and that helps sometimes. That helps. So I wrote a paper a couple years ago reviewing Professor Lenski's work and a number of other folks who have done laboratory evolution experiments over the years, and his results are not unusual. That's the commonest result for laboratory evolution. And from that, I coined something I called the first rule of adaptive evolution. If you're an organism and you have a change in your environment, and how's the fastest way you can adapt to that change? Well, you can break or blunt any functional coded element, like a gene or a gene control, whose loss would yield a net fitness gain. Okay? So that is the first rule in the sense of a rule of thumb, not some law. And the first rule, because this is the first thing that's expected to happen. The first rule of adaptive evolution, and I submit that this is not the kind of mechanism you would expect to be able to build those sophisticated and complicated molecular machines that we saw a while back. Here's another image that I'd like to leave you with. In Canada, do you guys, have you ever heard of Batman? Well, here's another one I got off the internet. And here we see the evil Joker blowing up a bridge as Batman and Robin come over in the Batmobile to try and capture him. Now, from the Joker's point of view, this is a beneficial change. Now Batman and Robin cannot capture him. He's safe for the moment. And it turns out this is, you know, almost literally what some cells do to protect themselves. There's this protein called Duffy antigen, which in some strains of malaria, that's the malaria parasite has to bind to a particular protein before it enters the red blood cell. And that's kind of the bridge to the red blood cell that it uses. And there's a population in West Africa which are completely immune to this strain of malaria. And the reason is that they have deleted the gene for the Duffy antigen. They have blown up the bridge. They have gotten rid of it in order to survive longer. So this is the kind of thing that that we can expect Darwinian evolution to do. So let's make a few points here. This is what observation demonstrates about random mutations. We've known for a long time that of those mutations that affect an organism, about 99% are detrimental. Now we know, because of work of Lenski and other folks, that of even beneficial mutations, the great majority break genes or degrade function. Okay. I'm running very low on time. So let me just say that, let me just skip ahead and leave you with something controversial. In my book, The Edge of Evolution, I go off the deep end, and I relate all this stuff to the anthropic coincidences that physicists talk about how finely tuned the universe is for life, too. And I kind of list in a row from the general features of nature, like the laws and physical constants and so, to the more specific ones, like what are the properties of DNA and the genetic code and so, down to various, much more specific, down to individuals, random mutations, and so on. And I make an argument, how far into nature does fine-tuning go? And we see that the laws, people have argued that laws of nature are fine-tuned. And with more information, we saw that other things were finely tuned well, including ratios of the fundamental constants and speed of expansion of the universe and so on. And even chemistry, such as the chemistry of carbon and the chemical properties of water, and including specific things in our solar system, our location of our solar system in the galaxy and the location of our planet in the solar system, down to the origin of life, which remains a very outstanding problem. And in my first book, I argued down that molecular machines were designed, and I'll use the word finely tuned now, kind of in analogy with this. And in Darwin, or in The Edge of Evolution, I make an argument that I can't make tonight simply because of lack of time, that fine-tuning extends at least to the category of classes, in like fishes versus birds versus mammals and so on. But I also emphasize that there certainly is contingency in biology. There's random mutations, there's accidents, there's all sorts of things. So that somewhere between species and genera and classes and order lies the edge of evolution, lies the edge of what, you know, unaided random processes can do in nature versus what required purposeful design. Okay, and with that completely undefended thesis, I will stop now and hand it over, back over.
Thank you, Dr. Beeney. We will now transition to a time of question and answer. So if I can call Peter up. Peter's just gonna help us moderate question and answer. Also, we don't have the ability to really have you guys line up because our stairs are jam-packed. So what we'll do is you guys can simply raise up your hand, speak as loud as you can, and say your question. Dr. Beeney will repeat your question and then answer it. Okay, just a couple of ground rules as well from Dr. Beeney is one, please make your question short. Two, don't come up here with a speech. Three, any follow-up question will be answered, but it must be short. So.
Thank you. Thanks. Those are just the rules of a good Q&A session, not mine. Okay, yes.
As natural selection proceeds, does the scope for random mutation increase or decrease, or is there no relationship?
Okay, the question was, as natural selection proceeds, does the scope for random mutation increase, decrease, or is there no relationship?
Right.
And I myself would say it likely decreases because as organisms become more and more specialized, and they would become more specialized by natural selection, they lose a lot of genetic information, and there's less information there to work with. And so I would think that the scope for further evolution is narrowing down. But I'm not going to say that's a strong opinion. That's just what I think off the top of my head.
Over there by the wall.
Maybe. I was wondering about deletion and how it degrades the genetics of an organism. How then is that considered intelligent design if then there is this ticking time bomb inside you where you delete coding regions of your genetics that would do very beneficial things, you blow up all your bridges, and all of a sudden you're not very well adapted to do anything?
Okay, that's a great question. It's not intelligent design. I said that intelligent design exists in nature, but that is not to say that there's no such thing as chance and contingency and randomness and so on. For example, you could buy a nice, you know, Porsche or something like that and be the, you know, chick magnet driving down the main street here and run into a parking meter or something like that. The fact that your Porsche is no longer so beautiful does not mean it was not designed, and it doesn't mean that accidents can't happen to it. Genetic accidents can happen all the time. You know, we see what was that, the drug in the 50s that caused all those birth defects? I'm sorry?
Thalidomide.
So selection based on broken genes and so on, I think, is easily explained by Darwinian processes. Random change happens to have a good effect in this environment, and so it's selected. Darwinian evolution is just, you know, wonderful at breaking things, and sometimes breaking things helps. So, you know, the fact that some fish that live in caves are blind because some genes are broken, that can be explained by Darwinian evolution. I'm happy to explain it by Darwinian evolution. But that does not explain where the eyes came from in the first place that later got broken. Things like that, I think, require design. Great question, and what I want to emphasize first is that I'm not arguing against evolution. I myself believe in common descent. I think organisms are descended from organisms in the past, but I do not think it was by random changes and selection. Rather, I think it was programmed or guided or somehow supervised by an intelligent agent. If we're talking about Darwinian evolution, I certainly do agree with you that it does not lead to perfection. It can lead to some improvements. It can lead to a stable situation, like some people survive in a malarious region because they have sickle cell trait, and some people die in the same region because they get sickle cell disease. I think that is... I think that's explained well by Darwinian evolution, but that I don't think is, I'm sure you agree, is not a perfect solution. And what's more, I don't think that sort of process can lead to the molecular machinery that everybody in biology thinks is so elegant. That's what we need to explain, not the random smaller changes that may or may not have positive effects.
So, I was wondering, would you agree that the existence of near same sequences of junk DNA in different species is statistically unlikely if they were not initially from an earlier same sequence?
The question was, do I agree that junk DNA sequences, that are sequences with no apparent function, which are very similar between two species, are good evidence that those two species descended from a common ancestor which first suffered, say, some mutation which rendered a functional sequence function less, and the two species diverged and both of them inherited that copy. And that can explain the situation. Well, I have to say a couple things. First, if that's what happened, it's fine by me. In other words, some people wonder if intelligent design is compatible with the idea of common descent, and yes, it is compatible with the idea of common descent. It actually says nothing about common descent. It just says that some things in life were designed. They have the trademarks of design. But as far as common descent goes, yeah, it's possible that indicates that they descended from a common ancestor. But it's also true, and I imagine you've been following it, that the idea of junk DNA has come in for a hard time of late. A project called ENCODE, whose experimentalists have gone on record as saying that almost a large fraction of the DNA of people and other organisms, presumably, is functional, despite the fact that we do not know what the function is. Now, that conclusion is still controversial as of now, but at least some people make the argument that just because we don't know what the function is doesn't mean it doesn't have a function. So that's essentially a classic argument from ignorance. Just we don't know it has a function, therefore it has no function. And that's you can't say that, at least you can't say it with firmness. The other thing is that some sequences of DNA not only are not, which people had thought were junk, not only are now ambiguous, they are known to have functions. That is, some pseudogenes, that is, some genes that look like real genes, except they have, you know, a mistake or what people thought was a mistake in the middle of them that doesn't allow the gene to be expressed and turned into a protein. Some of them seem to actually regulate the activity of the functional gene. And regulating the activity of another gene is itself a function. So I guess the long and the short is it's perfectly okay with me if those two did descend from a common ancestor. And I think the evidence does point strongly to common descent. But the particular example that you are choosing right now is turning out to be more problematic than we had thought not too long ago. Yeah, that's one way of thinking about it. That at least a subcategory of mutations are not random. This does not mean that the vast majority of mutations that do occur aren't random, but if a critical subset were selected or chosen or guided or programmed or some such thing, it at least theoretically could easily affect the course of life. So yes, I'm saying that I think that some changes are directed, some are designed.
Evolutionary theory doesn't predict how a population is going to adapt to selective pressures. It only says that it will, and if it fails to do so, then it becomes extinct. So because we haven't evolved defenses, there's no argument that we won't evolve defenses against malaria in the far geologic time span to come. And if we don't, we'll just become extinct. And two,
wait. My short-term memory is not. I'm 60 years old, man. You can have a follow-up question, but let me address yours first, because I will certainly forget what it is if I have to listen to the second one first. The question is, now I've already forgotten. I think the question was. Darwinian evolution doesn't predict that a beneficial or helpful mutation has to arise in a population. The population could go extinct. Or it might arise in later generations. So the question is, why am I arguing that these kind of less than optimal mutations are an argument against Darwin's theory, since it hardly even predicts that. Is that correct? More or less. Okay, here's why. Mutation is supposed to be random. And people, some scientists It's their thing to measure mutation rates. And on order, on average, there's a mutation in, say, mammalian DNA about one every 100 million times the DNA is copied at a particular site. Say this particular residue right here in DNA is mistakenly copied once every 100 million times. Now we have a large number of organisms. Say we have 10 to the 10th, 10 billion. Okay. It turns out that means that every nucleotide in that organism will have been mutated 100 times within that time frame. So statistically, we would expect to have covered all possible, at least substitution, mutations. And if there were a mutation that was more selectable than the sickle cell one, with some caveats, you know, with some caveats due to stochastic effects, leaving those aside for now, if there was a better mutation which had a larger selective effect, we would expect to select it in that time period. And so we would see this supposedly better mutation appear. Richard Lenski has shown that he can repeat evolutionary experiments, take a line of E. coli, grow it once, and then some mutation comes along and it's beneficial. And he grows another line, the same mutation comes along and it's beneficial. Another line, the same mutation comes along. And they're all degradatory mutations. And the reason is that they're pretty probable. All you have to do is knock out one gene, and the odds against that are 1 in 10 to the minus 5 or so in E. coli, which is a lot better than 1 in 10 to the minus 8 for changing a single nucleotide. So the thing we can say is that these are the best that the Darwinian mechanism can do in the population that has occurred up to that time. And if we think of a billion humans in a malarious region, and say 25 years per generation, and 10,000 years since the malarial parasite became very, very ferocious, then we'll have 400 times a billion humans. That's coming up on a trillion humans. So we can say that these mutations, the alpha thalassemia, the glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, the sickle hemoglobin, they are the best ones available in 1 times 10 to the 12th tries, in a trillion tries. Okay, second question?
Yeah. So that appropriately leads to the second question. What about stochastic inheritable epigenetic events? Why should mutations be the only driving force in evolution?
Okay. Well, that's another good question. So suppose it wasn't just the mutations I listed. Suppose there are things called epigenetic phenomena. That is, things that affect the DNA chemically or physically somehow and seem to get passed from generation to generation too without changes in the actual DNA sequence. And they seem to be getting to be a real hot subject these days. There seems to be more and more things being attributed to them. Well, that's the beauty of observation. You know, these 400 billion humans, call it a trillion, so I don't have to say 400 billion, these trillion humans that have existed in the past 10,000 years in malarial regions, they had epigenetics. They had everything we had, I assume. Nobody told them, you are only allowed to use Darwinian processes to to change your DNA or to help you against malaria. Anything that arose in that population which could offer a defense against malaria would have been selected, whether it be a point mutation like in sickle cell or whether it's the methylation of some cytosine in some gene in the respiratory system or something. So we don't have to say, the nice thing about this is that this rules out any change, any undirected change in a trillion organisms, whether it's due to a Darwinian mechanism, a Lamarckian epigenetic mechanism, self-organization. There's some people who think self-organization helps organisms to evolve, and there's some other minor points of view too. So that this observation rules these out.
Can I do a quick?
I'll leave it up to the.
I'll take a question on this side.
Sorry.
Me? Yeah. Oh, would you please share your opinion about how the origin of life happened?
Whoa. Why is that considered controversial? The long and the short of it is that I don't have one, other than to say that whatever it was not random. It could have been, in my estimation, now I'm a Christian, you know, people have taken pictures of me going into a church and coming out, so I can't deny it. So as far as I know, you know, God could have snapped his fingers, little puff of smoke, and there were two tiny amoebas there in the pond. Okay, maybe that was me. Or perhaps the designer or God, because this requires a lot of effort, set up the universe so that it unfolded, and what we think of as wildly improbable events were actually built into it from the beginning. That's got a name. It's called front loading. And as far as I can see, there's no logical contradiction between that and design. And there's many, I guess there's many other scenarios too. But I don't think we have enough evidence to choose between most of those scenarios.
Just to follow up.
Okay.
Yes.
So basically evolution is, I think, useless unless you have basically like a cell, right? Like you need something that's capable of like replicating itself and whatever, right?
So well, yeah, it's useless until you have a replicating system.
Yeah.
Okay.
And how does that just sort of arrive with nothing, you know?
From nothing? Sure, I'm not going to say it isn't, but suppose, when you talk about the origin of life, the origin of the universe, anything you say is going to strike many people as pretty wild, pretty crazy. So let me do that. Suppose Mr. Big Bang happened, you know, and later on the Earth forms, cools, and so on. There's various chemicals floating around in the ocean, you know, just randomly around. And two come together, and a cosmic ray comes from over on the left side of the horizon and hits those two chemicals and causes them to react where they otherwise would not. And another cosmic ray comes from the right side and hits them and a third chemical and causes that to react. And, you know, some plume of heat comes up and causes something further. And all together, at the end of the day, you've got a cell. I would say you can easily tell that cell was designed. But if you traced all of those cosmic rays back to the Big Bang and so on, you might not be able to see any change in the behavior of nature. Okay? So intelligent design is, the conclusion of intelligent design is independent of how the design was affected. You know, when people first discovered the statues on Easter Island centuries ago, when Europeans first discovered them, they didn't know how they got there. They didn't know how they were made, and it took centuries to figure out. But they knew right away they were designed. Okay? That's the great thing about design. You can tell design just by looking at the system that's in front of you. You see what I call a purposeful arrangement of parts. And we're good at detecting design. But how that design came about, you need more, and sometimes much more, evidence to come to a conclusion. Ask them all.
First, to be honest, I don't really understand what this slide shows, but you claim that the edge of random evolution is in orders, families, and genera. But how would your view be affected if I told you that genera, families, orders, and even classes are not natural categories, but rather artificial and arbitrary categorization created by humans?
Well, yes, I would agree with you 100%, but I would say that from what I'm going on is what we know, what science so far has been able to tease apart about how some of these things develop, about how fish develop, or how different cell types in different organisms develop. And I make an argument in my book that I can't go into now, that these cellular developmental programs are real complex and finely tuned and almost certainly designed. You could say that, well, what impresses us as a genera turns out just to be a bunch of species, or turns out to be unrelated species, or you could say that the families descended from an order should be classified as orders themselves. That will depend on our elucidating the molecular details of what differentiates one from the other. But since this was a kind of a bold attempt or a speculative attempt at trying to find the edge of evolution, I used what at the time, around 2005, 2006, was known about what is necessary for these creatures to develop. And I say, at least out of some classes of organisms that we know of, there would be big, big problems for random mutation and natural selection. And some species, if you look at the details, they aren't separated by anything other than, say, a big inversion of DNA, which could easily happen by chance, in my opinion, and opinion of many people. So that's why I say somewhere between our best knowledge of what's really elegant and which is not likely to be, is very unlikely to be the product of chance, and our best knowledge of what is, relatively easily accessible to chance down there at species, somewhere between those, and it's a big gap, is the edge. It doesn't have to be the same edge for insects versus, the orders of insects in a class of insects, or the families in a class of order of insects versus other organisms or plants. It doesn't have to be the same in plants. But I'm just saying that in what we know, and at least for mammals, that's a decent place to guess where we will find the edge of evolution. I convince you? Yeah. I can tell. I can see it in your eyes.
It's just that since they are arbitrary categorizations, I think it's inherently pointless to try to find something natural about them.
Yeah, well, that certainly has an honorable philosophical history. That has been argued about since the Greeks. And many people still argue that. But I'm not a philosopher. I'm a scientist. And it seems to me that when you get to, say, birds or something, that there's a good reason for grouping birds together in one class. And it's not really arbitrary because they share certain characteristics. But other people feel differently.
Thank you, Dr. Levy. I think just, you can give him a round of applause.